Welcome, everyone, to the Film Strip's bonus episode for 2018, the episode in which we discover how much we regret the choices we've made in life. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Canningeser. Oh, and hello there at the door. I didn't hear you come in. Won't you join us by the fire for a little chat?
Don't accept, or, well, you know, I was going to make a joke about, you know, not acknowledging the absence of the fire itself, but... yeah, that's pretty much indicative as to how this episode's going to go. So, welcome!
Well, at least now we've invited people in, so any vampires listening feel included.
Well, that's true. But, yeah, so welcome to the 2018 New Year's Eve special, the one in which, well, you can join us here on the show if you have nothing better to do, no loved ones to spend your time with.
Maybe some people just get really sick of Ryan Seacrest, too. You always sell so short, Dave. Maybe this is why... you know, year one wasn't when we rocketed to the top of the charts. We're too humble. That's the problem.
Yes, yes, that's the problem, and nothing else. But yes, so, at any rate, this is the podcast where typically on this show, in a regular episode, we would look at a film, and somehow the film under discussion has to connect back to the one that preceded it. And... we are going to get back to that at the start of 2019 with our first regular episode of that season, which will be what, Andrew?
That is going to be Don Siegel's The Beguiled with Clint Eastwood, not the new Sofia Coppola. We're going straight to the source. So if the first 41 episodes hasn't caught the world's attention, surely Civil War gender dramas with unreliable narration, that's going to be the ticket.
Absolutely. And do know, folks, by straight to the source, yes, we're talking about the film, not the book it's based off of, but...
Oh, man, maybe that could be our spinoff, where we just do the same except books, and every episode is four times longer.
Well, we could do it. I am working my way through a Star Trek Enterprise novel at the moment. Dealing with the Romulan War, the first of two books dealing with this subject.
Looks like Christmas came early for Dave.
Well, it was a book I bought 5 years ago at the time, being very excited to read it. It's like, yes, I can't wait to get into this. And, you know, here I am, you know, 5 years later. I'm getting to it, finally.
No, but, happy belated Christmas?
Sort of. So, but yes. So, what are we actually doing here on this episode, Andrew? Since, clearly it's not going to be one of our typical episodes.
Well, I mean, fair points to anyone who says there's no such thing as a typical episode. But, this week, we have decided we're going to take a little break from all the post-Christmas, pre-New Year's madness, and, hoping that everybody who has tuned in over the last year, and certainly over the last week, that you've made the holiday a memorable one for you and yours, and hopefully for all the right reasons. So we've decided that we're going to take a little bit of time to have a little discussion amongst ourselves about the year that was and the year that might be, or coming up.
That is
true. I mean,
true.
It will be a year coming up, just we don't exactly know what it'll consist of. And
hey, nothing says the apocalypse won't happen a week before this episode drops, so...
That's true. It's, because it was supposed to be 2012, right?
At one point, and then 2000 before that, and 2001 after that. And
yeah.
Yeah, let's just say the predictions have been wrong repeatedly.
Well, I mean, the Mayans did give us that John Cusack movie, so in a roundabout way, disaster was wreaked upon the world.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I guess that is the case.
But I guess to start us off, normally, as we record, well, we always do it from home over Skype, so we can both get comfortable, both sit in our favorite easy chair, look at our many bookshelves full of esteemed film theory, and not just a whole bunch of comic books and John le Carré novels, and... usually we have a beverage, but today we've mixed it up a little, haven't we, David?
If by mix it up a little you mean made choices which we're going to regret in about 5 minutes' time, yeah, we have. So, going back early into our run of episodes, not that early, really just a few months ago, we covered a little film called Bigger Than Life by Nicholas Ray. And for those of you who remember that episode, we'll remember... we quite enjoyed that movie, didn't we, Andrew?
It was easily one of the highlights, I think, of the first year of the show so far. Simply because, like, not only is it a great film, but it's great while being absolutely insane at the same time. And I think those threads came together when we were both delighted to see young Walter Matthau teach us how to make a health shake.
Yeah, and for those of you who don't remember this health shake, it was something called Tiger's Milk. Now, as thorough online research by myself has discovered, Tiger's Milk no longer means what it did, at least as far as 1956 in the cinema goes.
Did you look on Urban Dictionary?
Amongst other places.
That was your first mistake.
Yes, it was. The key thing here is that, no, this is not an alcoholic drink. There is no alcohol involved in this thing. No, no. Andrew, would you care to remind our listeners what that patented process that the good old Walter Matthau taught us at the time was?
Well, you see, I'm not doing the voice.
That's fair.
And not just because I can't. So I believe the recipe calls for one or half of a jar of yogurt. And then you spoon that into a glass or a blender, and then you apply a liberal tablespoon of blackstrap molasses, and then some quantity of brewer's yeast, which we never got the exact ratio of, because I think that's the moment when Barbara Rush walked in. So David and I know that it requires yogurt, molasses, and yeast. Now, we were talking before the show about whether or not this would actually be safe to consume, so this may be our first and last New Year's recap.
Absolutely. Now, with full honesty and transparency, because that's key to the show, if not, you know, from the government's perspective, what's important to note here is that neither one of us was able to fully follow the recipe as dictated in the 1956 film. Is that not correct, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, it's like absinthe, right? Where now they make it and it doesn't have wormwood, so you don't hallucinate and then choke on your own vomit. I mean, so it's a close approximation. We can't never go back to what was, but we can always try and come up with the next best thing. So Dave, what do you have in your mug?
So in this lovely little glass that I'm looking at and, you know, weeping over, it does indeed have plain yogurt. It also indeed has not necessarily blackstrap molasses, because I couldn't tell the difference between blackstrap, cooking molasses, and fancy molasses. And one awkward conversation with the grocery store employee later, I ended up going with the cooking molasses, the one that you would use in baked beans, because it had marginally more nutritious value. So assuming going by the basis of, you know, this being a health drink, I figured, why not? However, due to my concerns over the nature of whether yeast was or was not drinkable, and my inability to find brewer's yeast, it is not part of it. Substituted in its place is just a mild amount of milk, so that I can actually drink this in terms of it being relatively liquid-like.
Yeah, it's a drink, it's a spread, it's both.
Yes. But what about you, Andrew? You had a slightly different conundrum with yours.
Yes. So around the holidays, it's been a busy season at the office, so I kept forgetting at 5 o'clock when I leave to go to the bulk store and get some blackstrap molasses. So instead, I fashioned an ad hoc solution using some of the nutritional yeast from my cupboard and yogurt. Now, it did come from a plastic container, whereas Walter Matthau very specifically indicates a jar. So I'm going to blame any shortfalls on that.
Fair enough. So I guess on that note, Andrew, there's not really much point in putting off our terrible life choices much longer, is it?
I don't suppose so. It's we've gone from Christmas cheer to Christmas gastric duress, so no sense delaying the inevitable.
All right, so on the count of three, and listeners, if you wish to join us in this endeavor and make your own terrible life choices, pause now. Come back and join us when you have your version prepared.
Don't encourage them, David. Liability.
Okay, fair point. Don't drink this. Don't do this at home. This is a terrible idea. But you probably figure that out before we finish describing what was in this drink. So, on the count of three, Andrew, are you ready?
I was born ready.
All right, then. In 3, 2, okay, hold on a second. Are we sure we really want to do this?
Okay. I mean, you've given us a great hook for the episode. And honestly, maybe that's really the learning moment of the first year, that we discovered, hey, it's not just enough to have two guys talking about movies on a podcast. Because, I mean, frankly, What separates us from the other guys? You need those hooks. And I think finding out whether or not the boys are going to drink tiger milk is a wonderful hook to take us out of 2018. Though I am very curious. Otherwise, it's just a waste of good yogurt.
That's a good point. We will drink this, but maybe we'll just hold off for a little bit. So until that time, though, Andrew, maybe let's just sort of look back on our little show and our humble beginnings. Because, let's be honest, this show was certainly not a guarantee to be the, you know, 41 episode strong monolith that it has become.
Yeah, let alone keeping to a weekly schedule, which is something that I never thought I'd be capable of doing.
Well, this is the thing. This show, for those of you who may not have been here since the very beginning and haven't listened through our backlog, or maybe have just plain forgotten because really your life is likely filled with far more important things to be dealing with, we used to be a different show prior to this. The one thing called 24 Panels Per Second, which had a nice 5-year run. And that was more or less a monthly podcast hosted by myself and Drew Jeffries, and later on yourself, Andrew, and James, and Chris Martin. And, you know, it became a lovely ongoing endeavor. And then Drew just wanted to get the heck out of the business.
Well, after I think a point, it's safe to you say. Run out of comic book movies, and, I mean, it's a hard sell on anyone to look at the Man-Thing TV movie. But, yeah, I mean, that was my first experience with podcasting, and had it not been for doing graduate studies in Montreal and bumping into Drew again, none of it would have come about, nor would talking with you and realizing, even though I didn't think I knew you, I actually did, because your voice is unmistakable. And,
thank you.
Yeah, from that one time you guys were gracious enough to have me stumble my way through through Green Lantern. One thing led to another, and yeah, over part of that show's run, I mean, it was always yours and Drew's baby, but you guys were kind enough to have a couple of us along for the ride, and that ended up being one of the highlights of my time in Montreal and my time since. But as with all good things, eventually it had to come to an end. And, well, I don't know about you, but I was left with a great big hole in my schedule. And a lot of sadness, because I'm like, if only there was some way that I could come up with a different idea for a podcast, and then I'd always have an excuse to be a complete nerd with one of my friends once a week.
And thus, the cinema, well, what after numerous debates about what the heck the title of this thing and the exact concept. Actually, debates is probably far too strong a word. More like general discussions that eventually just led to a very simple, basic premise.
More like Andrew staying awake until 4 a.m., unable to sleep, and being like, "Hey, Dave, here's 16 ideas. What do you think?" And David saying, "Well, they all sound pretty good to me."
That was, yeah, fairly reasonable remembrance of the events as well.
And it's proof David's too kind, because if you could see my old notes, you'd realize that, no, they don't all sound good.
Well, like I said, I'm not sure that many of my ideas at the time were that much better. Point being, you know, I mean, eventually we settled on this particular concept, which still thus far has eluded us in terms of coming up with a quick, pithy way of describing each and every episode. But, beyond that, then there was the issue of the title. And this I remember more distinctly, because I think that we basically came down to about two titles for what the show could be. One was being ultimately Film Strips, and the one preceding it was a little something called Cinema Hop, because that sounded like a good idea to me at the time.
I think it's cute. I think it makes us sound way too much like a 1950s beach movie equivalent of podcasting.
Which, to be fair, was actually kind of the direction I was going with it in terms of what that title was supposed to evoke. But,
oh wow, so it's no accident that we ended up looking at Roger Corman in the first year.
Precisely. Dang it! Okay, that'll make more sense later on, folks, but trust me, you'll understand why I had that rage moment in a little bit.
Oh, wow. Normally, Dave saves his anger for immediately when we stop recording, and then he tells us what we really think about movies.
Yes, yes. The whole idea was they ultimately came down to, and I think Film Strips has worked out reasonably well as a title for us in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, you can stylize it. You can make a cool t-shirt. We have no time to ever get around to doing that. One day it'll come. The same way that one day I'll actually finish building a website for us. The same way that I'm one day going to get around to hustling other podcasts for mentions. The same way that one day we're going to look into advertising. The bottom line is, it's great to have all these ideas of what you can do with it. But honestly, we keep saying the first year. It's been 41 episodes, so a bit less, but this marks the end of the calendar year. So I've realized over the course of it that, you know, honestly, even if this is all that our show ever becomes, just me and David talking over Skype and me still refusing to put money down on a standalone microphone, I enjoy doing this so much with you that even if we never get an additional listener that is not a friend or relative of ours, and even if we end up losing money on the whole endeavor, I think it'll be time worth spent.
Well, I will say, A, I absolutely agree with you, but also, it's worth noting that there must be people beyond our friends and immediate family listening to this. At least I assume so, because I can guarantee most of my family does not listen to the show, nor do I blame them.
My dad listened to the Red October episode, though. And he did make it a point to say, that David has an excellent voice for podcasting.
Why, thank you, Mr. Kanagan.
And then I asked him about myself, and he said, you have an excellent face for podcasting.
And, okay, but yes, the key thing is, you know, we usually average, you know, well, I won't give the exact number, but I'll put it this way, it's high enough to suggest that there is some people outside our immediate vicinity of circle of friends and family who listen to this show.
Which so, admittedly was mind-blowing when you first started telling me some of the numbers, because, I mean, I've done some failed podcasts before. I mean, you hit that point in your life where you sort of accept that you're never going to be more than locally famous for anything, and we're not going to be locally famous for our podcast, but at the same time, against all odds, maybe it's just goodwill or people passing it on for the wrong reasons, but sir, we've routinely went beyond my expectations for it, and is it the third man that's still our all-time high at this point?
I think the third man was our highest. Like you say, it's hard to tell because the way in which we get the information from the sources we deal with basically ends up, you know, it doesn't really tell us what episodes were downloaded and who these people were. It just gives us hard numbers on number of downloads and number of, you know, streams of the episode proper.
We can figure out more if we paid for the metrics. And I mean, when we don't even have a Patreon account that you can go give us money at, believe me, we're not soliciting right now. But maybe one day we'll actually find out that, turns out that month only 3 people download The Third Man and everybody else wanted to hear about The Last Unicorn.
And that could be. You never know. Point being, but yeah, I think The Third Man, taking the evidence at generally face value and assuming that everybody was listening to the most recent episode at that time, was our highest episode. Now, usually there is a point I know that we are hovering at, and I'll let you know what that exact number is after the end of the show here, Andrew. Not because I don't think we can trust anybody with this information, but we have to keep a little bit of mystery on our part.
Well, exactly. They know what's in our mugs right now, so they don't need to know how many people are hearing us kill ourselves for entertainment.
Precisely. Oh, God, that's the second time!
Wow, this has been, it's just like the holidays at my house, apparently.
So, okay, calm blue ocean. The key thing here is, having now done this show on a regular basis, week after week after week, and coming down, you know, we've done 41 episodes. You know, that's not a bad number to have achieved in a single year without even starting at the very beginning of the year. Because I think we launched in February, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. So that's about the, the first few episodes we were doing ended up running, you know, about hour 15, hour and a half. Then we got kind of long in the tooth for a while. I think aggregate, I totaled it up a couple weeks ago, and I think you could listen to the episodes we've recorded for about 3.5 days straight, which I wouldn't recommend doing all of those at home who we love very dearly. But yeah, I mean, honestly, Dave, I'll definitely give you some credit for keeping me rigorous and like keeping us on schedule, because especially in the early going, before this thing started gaining any traction, it can be very difficult to be motivated. It can be even more difficult to be motivated when you know, like, there's not necessarily, I guess, like, an actionable outcome that you're expecting from something. And, I mean, there's definitely a lot of joy in doing things for the pleasure of doing them. But at the same time, when you've got all sorts of responsibilities to juggle and you're getting off work and you think, well, I have to go home and talk about Highlander 2 to an audience of none, that can be difficult. And yet, every single week, we end up back together, we end up talking about it, and I always feel so much better for having done it, so.
Well, it's a thing. I mean, partly part of my own motivation here is, and I will flat out admit it, I am not particularly fond of most contemporary film conversation, as it were, the discourse in popular culture, because on various ends of it, I think certainly when it comes to academic or highly critical literature, so much of it is, it's not that it's bad, but it is so detached from the lived-in experiences of the majority of people who go to the cinema that it feels like it really is just self-serving in a way, more so than anything else. And that bugs me. At the same time, oh my goodness, the sheer amount of, you know, whether it's podcasts I've listened to or reviews I've read where everything is, oh, this sucks, and that's the level of quality you get for the entire insight that's provided throughout the entirety of the review, or it's all about how much snark and how snarky we can be about every single little detail in terms of, and essentially, how do you put this?
Well, it's like, who could be most acerbic? Like, we live in a time where irony has a lot of value in terms of cultural production. And I mean, I think what it comes down to is knowing how to pick your targets. And yeah, you can't apply a broad brush to the entire film landscape, because so far in 41 episodes, we took it as a given from the go that film is a very varied art form. And speaking to that point, like, most films don't view themselves at any point in their production as an art object. You know, films are popular entertainment, and I think we've certainly said as much in previous episodes, but I think we've always made an attempt to sort of bridge the fact that you and I both have academic training in film analysis, balancing that against the fact that first and foremost, you and I are film nerds. And yeah, it's bridging the discourses of sort of the insular criticism with the sort of slavish and reactionary fandom. I think that's where we try and live that middle space there. Because you're right. I mean, just pointing out everything that's wrong with a movie isn't necessarily additive, but neither is talking about, you know, Merchant and Ivory films and just pointing out how painterly and wonderful they are. You know, so I think with us, what and maybe why the episodes where the film I'm least familiar with end up being the most fascinating discussions, like, a big part of coming into each episode for me is that I'm just excited to have that discussion with you. Because, I mean, we go back and forth, we draft up some notes, we highlight pertinent research and that, but in terms of do we sit down and do we plan out our debate and conversation? No. Do we sit down and plan out, like, certain lines to hit? No. We probably ought to in some episodes. And you can tell when Andrew's having a bit of a nighttime cold. But that being said, like, yeah, I think with our show, it's, by approaching it as a discussion, I find that personally, like, I'm always interested because I love talking about films with you, Dave. So the fact that we can do it in a slightly structured environment, I mean, that's just something I look forward to.
Absolutely the same here. And I think it's more about that, yeah, notion of getting away from the really super high-strung, high, you know, aggressive investment that so much of modern film discourse is, where everything is win or lose. There is no middle ground. There is, everything must be at the absolute height of everything, or it's worthless. And I hate that approach to film conversations. I mean, I cannot stand hyperbole to that degree on a regular basis. It just drives me up the wall. And certainly, I think that partly explains why I think some of the general trajectory we see with some of our conversations in terms of the films that we've had under discussion, because I broke down generally what the decades of the films we covered come from, just for my own amusement, more or less. And I think it was we came to some interesting results, I say, in terms of where we generally tend to follow and where we've been and what we've more or less avoided as well.
Well, yeah, because the first episode really, sort of the pilot, and when we ended up looking at One from the Heart, I mean, that was really the only episode where we had extensive back and forth about, no, we're going to pick this film. Because generally, yeah, otherwise, like every subsequent one, sort of we alternate picks. And, I mean, we have to sort of make sure that each other has access to that film in some fashion. But beyond that, I mean, there's not a lot of structure there. So one thing, as I know I've pointed out many times, I love the little organic patterns that end up forming. Sometimes doing an episode and then a follow-up episode that is, you know, similar genre territory from a different perspective, or continuing a certain theme, aside from when we got four episodes straight where we were qualifying every discussion because we ended up looking at critical race theory.
Yeah.
So looking at the decade breakdown, though, it's interesting to see where our tastes tend to gravitate. So, according to your chart, David, leading the pack with 10 of 41 episodes, they come from, and I am not at all surprised by this, the decade of you and I, the 1980s.
Precisely. Three! The 1980s, we at 10 episodes, we covered One from the Heart, Kiss of the Spider-Woman, Where the Buffalo Roam, Angel Heart, The Last Unicorn, The Return of Swamp Thing, Eating Raoul, White Dog, Flashdance, and American Pop. And even within that decade, I think it's fairly safe to say we covered a pretty broad spectrum of genres and filmmakers within it. Because, we started with Ford Coppola and ended up at Bakshi by the end of
it. Yeah, that's a bit of a leap. I mean, I think also in doing that, I mean, Return of the Swamp Thing does not feel like an 80s film. For some reason, in my mind's eye, that's a 90s. But, for all we try and homogenize the decade as the 80s, it's like, well, no, there's just as much variety as ever. And the same is true of any period in time, really. It's just knowing where to look for those outliers.
Well, yes. And the key thing here is, I mean, certainly there's a difference between the early 1980s and then where we end up by the mid to late 80s, which are very distinctly different in terms of tone and style and that sort of crushing the last remaining vestiges of the 1970s before heading into the 90s. Which, speaking of the 90s, of course, ended up being our second highest decade. No surprise given that we were predominantly children during this decade. So we covered a total of 9 films there.
Yeah, that surprised me to see. I almost would have naturally assumed like 60s or 70s would be the runner-up.
Well, and here's the thing. So the titles we covered were Street Fighter Heat, Dead Man, 54, Hunt for Red October, Highlander 2, The Quickening. Although, yes, you can put an asterisk beside that one, given the technical snafus on that episode that resulted in,
yeah, of all the episodes we had to lose, it ended up being Highlander 2, The Quickening. So, I mean, that's further proof that sometimes magic just happens organically.
Precisely. Precisely. God! Okay.
Easy
yes,
day.
Yes, Andrew.
Maybe we should let everybody know why you keep choking on your own tongue.
Okay, so I am making a resolution here, folks, given that this is an episode being released on New Year's Eve. While editing the Robe episode, I came to notice that I was using the word precisely about 8 billion times within the course of the first 11 minutes. I need to stop that. I honestly appreciate how anybody has remained with our show and listened to me as I, you know, stumble through and stutter my way through this program and then overuse the words precisely and ostensibly. And I can at least say that 99% of the time, I'm at least using ostensibly correctly. So it bugs me when I come across episodes where I've used it incorrectly. So if anybody's ever sat there and said, well, he's using the big word wrong. I know. Trust me. I know.
Dave, I think you're entirely too hard on yourself. I've always seen your use of ostensibly as a delightful affectation, because I can't think of any other film podcast that I listen to where that word even comes up at all. So, you know, thanks to you, Dave, you're educating the youth of today. You're helping maintain the cromulence of the English language. And, you know, I think that deserves a little credit.
All right, fine. I'll take that one. But mark my words, folks. Call me out in 2019 when I'm getting to keep doing this.
Yeah, so James, if you're listening, you know, we can give you a non-endorsed check for $7 every month if you tweet after every episode with an ostensibly count.
Yes, there we go.
Hey, now our show's interactive.
Hooray! But, okay, so to return from that brief digression to the 90s. So yeah, we did Street Fighter Heat, Dead Man 54, The Hunt for Red October, Highlander 2, The Quickening, Candyman, Farewell to the Flesh, Gods and Monsters, and Shakes the Clown. And the thing was, up until that last run between Candyman, Gods and Monsters, and Shakes the Clown, the 90s would have been probably about one or two down, comparatively. So really, when we cover the 90s, we tend to do it in a nice long string, it seems, at least thus far.
Yeah. And actually, now that you point that out, that's true, because Street Fighter was our third episode, Heat was our fourth, thanks, yeah. Wes Studi, and Dead Man came shortly thereafter. So, I mean, it seems like once we get in a decade, we tend to stay there for a little while.
Yeah, in the 90s in particular, because, yeah, once we ended up with The Hunt for Red October, we ended up at Highlander 2 afterwards. So... yeah, the 90s is, you know, really, it is a late bloomer for us. But, you know, again, it kind of makes sense. We, you know, both of us were born sort of in the mid-80s, ended up growing up predominantly in the 90s. So it's not surprising that a good chunk of cinema that we covered would come from there.
Well, and for more practical reasons, it's a lot easier to watch the movie and prepare for the episode when you actually remember what happens.
That is also true. Then that brings us to our third option, only behind by one, even and for the longest time, would have been our second highest decade, and that was the 1960s, surprisingly enough. So that time, our first episode of the 1960s was Machine Gun McCain, and from there we covered Chimes at Midnight, The VIPs, Premature Burial, Father Goose, The Mirage, The Split, and In the Heat of the Night. So,
have to do a star rating. So this will be the one time a year that we check in, and you can grade it from a to
Yeah. But I I'm quite pleased with this decade, mainly because we didn't cover most of the typical stuff that one would expect over the course of, because the night,
other than In the Heat of the Night, I mean, I can't imagine there were a lot of people that that look back on the 60s and be like, oh yeah, that was a great time for cinema. Father Goose was riding high, Chimes at Midnight was being made in Spain under fascism, John Cassavetes wasn't dead yet.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. I mean, one of the things I am very pleased about the show is the ability to cover, like, it's not that I'm against covering, you know, high profile titles, but it's very nice to find the curiosities and oddball ones that don't necessarily get talked about nearly enough, because really, when you get down to it, can we honestly add that much more to the conversation about 2001 A Space Odyssey?
Well, I mean, many people awesome. Probably could, but I think you and I are both self-aware enough to know that we're not the people that are going to be able to.
Exactly. So, I mean, yes, we will probably cover other Kubrick movies at some point in time. And we've already promised at least one person to pop up on the show when we do. But, yeah, I mean, certainly, the 1960s has proven to be a very interesting decade in terms of the films we got to cover. Now, coming in at fourth here is the 1970s, which we kicked off with Farewell, My Lovely, following with Deep Red, The Wicker Man, Superman the Movie, Logan's Run,
Carousel is a Lie,
Star Trek the Motion Picture, and Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So, yeah, so, you know, again, I'm almost surprised we didn't cover more of the 1970s.
As am I, at this point. Because personally, like, the 1970s and the Hollywood Renaissance, that's probably the period I look back on most fondly. I mean, full disclosure, like, I haven't been a film student and, like, part of the Academy for quite some time now. And, you know, upon leaving, I think I sort of doubled down the other direction where I'm like, well, I've had it with you hoity-toity ivory tower types. I'm just going to watch Super Troopers and nothing but for the next year. But yeah, like when I look back, like the late 60s, early 70s, that's generally what I think of when I think of like when movies were the best. And I mean, like, that's a facile distinction any more than it is to say that about any other decade, because there's just as much variety and, like, stylistic challenge and innovation happening then. There's just something very cool about the 70s.
Yeah, well, it's the thing. With the 1970s, because so many praise it, I'm always the sort of hesitant one to sit there and say, well, the 70s isn't necessarily that much better. I mean, its importance is unmistakable, and there are, again, it's unmistakable how many great films come out of that decade. So you can't take away its historical relevance. I am also
well, one otherwise of those people you go from 1969 to 1980, and then the world would tear itself apart.
True. But then again, I mean, the thing for me is I'm always happy to sort of push for the decades I think that don't necessarily get the most respect, necessarily. I mean, certainly the 1950s, I think, is a decade that really often gets unfairly overlooked in terms of what came out of it. Because it is that decade that exists in this weird point of tension between what's going to come and what's come before it. And seeing that sort of bubbling to the surface on cinema screens is interesting. Not to mention, I am a sucker for that sort of 1950s gee whiz era of wonkiness that we don't really see in contemporary cinema.
That genuine optimism about the future, you know, that is sorely lacking. And it has been a bit of a treat to go back and sort of encounter that. And I mean, the 50s is also interesting because even though the quote-unquote problem of television, you know, from the beginning of the decade, like, it was something that studios were planning for and at least being considerate of, and then as the decade progresses, it grows into a full-blown panic. And it's interesting because, yeah, like, I think if hard-pressed, you could make the same case of, like, the industry responding to some crisis across any decade. But in the 50s, it's especially pronounced, I think. And sort of in response to TV, we see that push for, like, the more cinematicness coming out. As a result, like, there's that doubling down on film-specific techniques and, you know, creating films with the idea of them being exhibited in, like, Grauman's Chinese theater in mind. And, I mean, it does lead to some really bizarre missteps, like the film Kiss Me, Kate, for instance, which there's no way that you could make sense out of it. Cole Porter's in it, but he's not Cole Porter. He's an actor playing Cole Porter, yet they acknowledge that he's the one who wrote it. It's very odd. It's also 3D, and none of that has anything to do with where I was going. The point is that, as we saw in The Robe, you see things like CinemaScope come out, and as we see in films like Bigger Than Life, we see Hollywood trying to grapple with real-life issues and not contain it in the same everything's okay framing that we're accustomed to.
Exactly, which, having named two of the three films that we covered in the 1950s, we should also note that we did Johnny Guitar as well, which you know, gives us, you know, some really interesting things to digest and work with, and also a really terrible Mercedes McCambridge performance that I will never get over.
History will vindicate Mercedes McCambridge.
I think history's already vindicated Mercedes McCambridge, but I stand by my statement. Well, it's a bad performance.
It vindicates Mercedes and instead shoves all that scorn back on Ward Bond for ratting everyone out to HUAC.
Which, of course, brings us to our favorite element of the 1950s that we can never escape, which is, yes, the House of Un-American Activities Committee.
Even when we're not trying, like, we'll go four episodes where everyone got called in front of HUAC, or this was written by someone who is blacklisted, and then we'll get away from that, and then, like, five episodes later, it's like, oh, directed by Edward Dimitrik, who testified before HUAC. And I was like, I'm just glad because I can make my Ward Bond's testimony joke every single time. I don't care if anybody at home laughs, because I do.
Man, just wait until we get to the film Hitler Dead or Alive one day, because, you know, I will let you go all to town on Ward Bond at that point.
Oh, man. Ward Bond, your days are numbered.
Assuming you weren't already dead.
His career sure was. The 1950s. And following that, with a grand total of two films, we have the 1940s.
Yes, so... Again, kind of surprising when you consider how many classics and important films come out of the 1940s. But yeah, we only covered two, The Third Man and Suspicion.
Those are two appropriate ones given our MO. Because, I mean, Suspicion is Hitchcock, but it's not one of the most notable ones. And, I mean, The Third Man, I do not understand why so few people have seen it. Like... I think out of all the movies we've looked at, that is the one I would point to and be like, yep, that is a flat-out masterpiece of cinema.
Well, and that's the thing. I think we've covered a couple of those. I mean, Third Man, I think, is certainly on that list. I will go to bat for Bigger Than Life for sure, because that thing is just a jaw-dropper of a film when you watch it. And, you know, even looking, I mean, not necessarily to the same extent, Hunt for Red October is a film that isn't nearly as in-depth or nuanced or complex as either of those films. But again, as a piece of thriller craftsmanship, it is a precise machine that just works on everything it aims to do.
Yeah, it is a very solid blueprint for sort of the style of action cinema that would follow through the 90s.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think those three for sure are up there. And I would say, you know, Angel Heart's probably... It gets close. It really, really gets close to being part of that.
It gets close. I think it's also recency bias, or maybe, I guess, inverse recency bias, where, I mean, like, I remember as a kid, like, I would watch any film, and if I really liked it, I'd be convinced it was the best movie ever made. I remember being 13 years old and making a list of the 50 greatest films of all time. I'm pretty sure I put either Apocalypse Now or Akira as number one, but I also remember, like, The Flintstones being in there, Felix the Cat the Movie being in there, I remember Almost Famous by Cameron Crowe. Like, I watched it the week before and put it on my list because I liked it. And yeah. I'd be very curious to find my parents' old Pentium computer with a 90 megahertz processor and see just what was on there and be like, was I this insufferable as a kid as well? I mean, I know full well in my mind that yes, I very much was. But it's just, I feel like The Third Man is one of those safe and settled films where anybody who has seen it, I feel like it's impossible to see it and not just be absolutely wowed by. And, I mean, to compare that to something like Angel Heart, like, I don't think a comparison can be made because, like, as we've tracked through 41 episodes, Hollywood changes dramatically year to year. So the kind of film that you're making 40 years removed from another, it's like you're basically speaking different languages. Angel Heart, I would say... it's definitely an excellent film. Whether or not it'll stand the test of time, I don't know. I guess we'll have to reconvene 40 years from now and see what I think then.
That is true. But that then brings us to our final decade, which technically is tied for last place with the 1940s, which is the 2000s, in which we covered two movies exactly. The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Oh, I always forget we did that one.
It was our introduction to Sean Connery. How could you not forget that one?
Oh.
And Punch Drunk Love, which, you know, is fairly recent, and I'm sure most of our listeners remember that episode as well. I think what's probably more surprising here is what we haven't covered, or where we tend to end up, because we haven't done anything prior to 1940 yet, so I'm not necessarily surprised that we haven't done a silent movie as of yet, because we'll get there.
Well, I was thinking about, actually, when we were... coming up on Hitchcock, I thought that there would be the opportunity to do some of his silent ones, but one of the dilemmas whenever we're picking a film is that we don't want to box ourselves in where the only thing we can do for the next 4 weeks is like a Ruggiero Deodato film, or, you know, we end up picking something so marginal that, like, there's no way to come back from it. Because I'm like, as much as I like Hitchcock's The Lodger, I'm like, well, I can't off the top of my head think of a lot of other films that Ivor Novello has been in.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it's certainly the same reason why we haven't covered that much in the way of foreign cinema either, because, yeah, I mean, the farthest afield I think we've gone is Italy at this point, and the thing about it is at least with those films, there's generally generally, we're able to get it back to somewhere else pretty easily afterward without too much effort. Like, you do a Dario Argento film, you've got places to go. There's usually at least one English-language cast member which can tie us back to somewhere else. If we ended up going to, you know, a realm of cinema in which either, A, we have very limited knowledge, and B, where the... it's a matter of, can we actually access the films we need for it? It becomes trickier. I mean, there's plenty I would love to do out of, say, Japan. Whether we always have access to that is going to be a very big question. Well, and,
yeah. But I mean, also, just for more selfish reasons from the get-go, I kind of wanted to focus on films that preferably hadn't seen before and had some inkling that they were probably going to be good, because life is too short for bad movies. I mean, I recognize that they make up a big part of the marketplace and that there's always value in watching something. But at least from the hop, I'm like, I'm busy. I don't want to waste my time with stuff I hate. If anything, these 41 episodes have convinced me that even if we pick some random shot in the dark, you know, a South Korean horror film that you and I have never heard of, because that connects somewhere, I'm at least a lot more inclined to go with that now.
Well, it's, yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's certainly, we can justify it a little bit better in terms of, well, at least it might make for an interesting episode. But also, I mean, certainly it probably also alleviates me, because unlike you, Andrew, and much to the dismay, I think, of Drew, who was back on our show when we did the Return of Swamp Thing episode. Yeah, I have this thing. I will revisit bad movies, or I will deliberately seek out films I'm reasonably sure are bad, just for the experience of watching it and exploring, well, why didn't this work? Or how did this end up this way? And yeah, I find some of these things fascinating, and will occasionally from time to time come back and rewatch them.
Well, yeah, because there are many ways that a film can go wrong. I mean, like, one of probably the earliest surprises in our run was discovering that Street Fighter is a pretty bad movie, but it's also amazing. But I mean, the VIPs, I would say, is a very, it's a very competent film, and it's also atrociously bad, but for very different reasons, and for the same kind of reasons that watching the VIPs, even if you try and do it ironically, there's no fun to be had in that. And I think that's why you and I, we sort of shorthand the first category with the word bonkers. A film like Street Fighter, a film like Flashdance, you know, films of that nature. That crosses into bonkers territory. Logan's Run is pretty bonkers. Bigger Than Life is probably the best bonkers film that we've looked at, where it's like, even if it's bad, it's just, there's something almost audacious in how crazy it is. You know, like Street Fighter, so much of the paratext and so much of the attempts of humor and political commentary, like, it makes no sense how anyone ever greenlit it is beyond me, but I am also so deeply grateful this holiday season that somebody did.
Well, exactly. I mean, these films are just, when they go that weird and that wrong, they are end up being little works of art in their own right. And yes, I mean, Street Fighter might be the most joyous bad film we've watched for the show. I mean, certainly Flashdance is bad. It's fascinating. But, I mean, there's just as much stuff to sort of groan and, please, why isn't this still in the movie? Problems. Whereas the VIPs, oh, man. Honest question, did we cover a worse movie this year than the VIPs?
Honestly, I don't think we did. League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is bad, but it's that kind of like glossy, inert sort of badness where it's just, okay, Sean Connery's being a dick and nothing looks good and no one has anything to do, as opposed to the VIPs where, like, I mean, listen to the episode where we can really get at the root of it, but like, its class blindness is a problem. The fact that it's romanticizing toxic human behaviors is a problem. And it makes the fatal mistake that, at least for me as a viewer, like the only irredeemable films make. And that is, we are required to feel sympathy for Richard Burton. And that's just a bridge too far for me.
Oh, man. I keep feeling, even by accident, we're going to keep coming back to Richard Burton over the course of this show.
I'll be putting a curtain on Richard Burton once I'm done with Ward Bond.
Well, yeah. I mean, I would not be surprised by this. But no, I mean, I would absolutely agree. I mean, the thing about it is, I think that really irks me is that, you know, there is still a generation of people who would probably look at the VIPs and say, oh, well, it's sort of the height of, you know, sort of, I mean, it's not a great movie, but it's still, you know, classic old school Hollywood filmmaking. Well, yeah, but take a look at it. Really, really take a look at what you're sitting there thinking is this great romance. It's not. It really, really isn't. It is as vapid and terrible and toxic as any number of contemporary films.
Well, I think the reason why that's more infuriating is because of that sort of inertness in the presentation. It's the wolf at the door, right? Where, and I mean, in sort of, especially as we discovered, like a lot of people posted fan reviews talking about like, oh, I remember this film from way back. It's a nice throwback to a forgotten era where beating a woman up is proof of love. I think there's a lot more danger in those films that kind of mask themselves. I mean, for all people are freaking out about, say, anytime Lars von Trier comes out with a film, certainly with The House That Jack Built, like, yes, it's a controversial film, and no, I'm probably not going to be in any hurry to go out and see it, but it's also a film that is very upfront about what it is, what it's doing, and what attitudes it's meant to inquire within, or possibly, like, the reactions it's trying to provoke from an audience. It's a much bigger problem, I think, when it does get that pass, because, oh, it's just light. It's light cinema. It's not terribly deep or complicated. It's not meant to be consumed that way. Because when you take that approach, like, you're sort of inviting in all the trappings that come with it, only without the advantage of being able to critically engage with it. And I mean, that's not necessarily a problem that's unique to this film. I think sort of that disguising of message allows for a lot of problematic parts of discourse to continue to circulate through our world. But certainly in the context of the show, I think the VIPs was the most egregious example of that.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's nothing that was quite as anger-inducing, and putting even that aside, just boring when you got right down to it.
Come on, it wasn't exciting watching a bunch of people wring their hands over money. Or watching that old woman take a bunch of pet pills?
Ugh, don't even remind me about that.
Hey, Dave.
That whole...
Remember that time that old woman did a bunch of pep pills? Sorry, I forgot you asked me not to.
yeah. But on a completely different end of the spectrum, to sort of return from where we had originated from this from, there's also the fact that we never covered anything from the 2010s. And I think I addressed a little bit earlier in a roundabout way, I'm not too upset about that fact by any stretch, because do we really want to be engaging in conversations about films that people have, for the most part, likely talked to death and have very entrenched, angry opinions about? I'm not sure I do.
See, there's a couple that I think about, but mostly because I know that I'll be unearthing a lot of entrenched, angry opinions from you. The other week, I remember being so upset that we could have connected to the Jason Statham Parker remake from a few years ago.
I'm sure, I'm not saying we're going to avoid the 2010s altogether.
And when we were talking about Italian cinema a few minutes earlier, I was just realizing, okay, Italian cinema, Giancarlo Giannini, he was in Hannibal. That means we can connect it to Red Dragon, the greatest Thomas Harris adaptation of them all.
People, you have no idea how close I was to choosing that one, just so I could finally 100% try and exercise that from my system forever. Because, man, I've said it before and I'll say it again. I have a lot of opinions about that movie. A lot of opinions about that movie. Basically because it is a more or less a unnecessary secondary adaptation of a great novel that had already been made into my all-time favorite film. So, you know, it had a lot stacked against it, and somehow it still failed to even meet the modicum of expectations I had for it.
Well, don't tip your hand too early. We might end up doing it. I mean, sooner or later, we're going to stumble across Ray Fiennes or Edward Norton or anybody else who had a fire sale on their artistic dignity, said the guy sitting on the couch recording into a laptop onboard mic over Skype. I guess, Dave, though, and sort of we've, as is our custom, our threads have been crossing all over the place. Let me ask you this. Because, sure. I mean, we've sort of signaled what we think are some of the better films we've watched and some of the worst ones. Let me ask you this. What films have been, for good and for bad, the biggest surprises of the first year?
Well, it all depends upon how we want to define surprises necessarily, whether it's surprise in terms of the quality of the conversation or how much we wrung out of it. Certainly, I would say probably, conversation-wise, the biggest surprise for me was Where the Buffalo Roam, as odd as that may be to say, because I was not anticipating that one getting as into the minutiae and ductwork of that movie as we ended up going. And that's a good thing, because I think that film, as much as you hate it, Andrew, and I know you hate it, there was a ton to pull out with that thing.
That's true. I mean, Art Linson is just lucky that the VIPs came along. I think that may be the episode where the sort of loose format that we adopt, I think that's the episode where we kind of recognize, like, hey, maybe this is the approach we should take. Because I remember that being sort of an eye-opener of, well, the film is terrible, and I absolutely love talking about it with you. I also remember getting very angry because all of the reactionary leftism that I've quelled by being an office drone came right to the fore.
Yeah, but what about you, Andrew? What would you say was the most surprising to you?
Let's see. Father Goose was a surprise, only because when you showed me the trailer, I was convinced that I was never going to speak to you again. Superman the movie was a surprise, because I remember it being good. I did not remember it being just as awe-inspiringly great as it was. I would say, though, and honestly, like, in terms of surprise, this I'm qualifying as the most surprising episode for me. The Last Unicorn, because I had not seen the film previously. I knew very little about it. I watched it, and I figured it was just going to be David defending the film, and me sandbagging. And sure enough, that is what happened, but it happened in the most constructive and illustrative way that, like, I think that's one of those movies I'll always point to where it's like, every now and then people say, well, what's the point in critiquing or reviewing bad movies? Or, like, what about movies that aren't meant to be art? It's like, Last Unicorn, I think, is very confused and very misguided, and I would happily spend another 2 hours talking about it with you on a recording.
Yeah, as would I. I mean, it is... I mean, I'm not sure whether we necessarily will have a complete additional 2 hours to build off of there. But, yeah, no, I would agree with you. That one certainly, which is basically a... I don't want to say it's a forgotten 80s film, because it has a very hardcore audience, including, as I was stunned to discover organically over the course of this year, amongst people significantly younger than us, Andrew, I will say. There's quite a few people who know this film and like it.
Right. Well, maybe I'll bust that out in the new year to watch with my daughter, and then she can tug at my arm and be like, hey, Dad, why does the unicorn seem so detached? And I'm just like, oh, that's just Mia Farrow, dear. That's how she is. Dad, why is the wizard from Brooklyn?
That one's much more confusing. But, the other thing. We need to cover more Alan Arkin in the new year. I mean, really, just come on, folks.
If you had ever a film with Jimmy Stewart, I think you and I should have an entire episode in character.
Oh,
that'll be the last one. Now, what about in a narrower sense? Like, what's a film that you thought, or even if you had seen before going into, you figured you were going to dislike, and then ended up more than exceeding your expectations?
In a good way or a bad way? Let's put it exceeding it in terms of
let's say in
better
a good way.
Honestly, this one's a bit tougher to say. I would probably say American Pop, because again, Bakshi is somebody who I'm not the biggest fan of. I think I've admitted as much on the actual episode, which was, just 2 weeks ago from when you last listened to this, folks. And yeah, it's just, it's one of those, I don't expect much from Bakshi when watching his work, and I was surprised by how good American Pop ended up being.
You really don't expect nuance from a Bakshi film, and I mean, that's not to say that it's a subtle work. No one's going to be mistaking that for the work of Ozu or anything like that, but I mean, considering the films that he is known for, when you look back on that one, it's like, oh, well, it's a real shame that he made Fritz the Cat first and a whole bunch of cartoon characters having group sex and talking about bathrooms. Because it turns out there is a talented filmmaker trapped inside his own body. I think, as you put it, Bakshi really is his own worst enemy. And when he gets out of his own way, if it means that he makes films like American Pop, I mean, Ralph, get out of your way more often.
Well, it's the thing, and it's the same thing with filmmakers. Like, I mean, you previously brought up Lars von Trier earlier on, and the sort of, enfant terrible, I'm not even going to pretend I know. There we go. Yeah, it's been years since I took French, folks. I'm not good with it. But the point of the matter is, I really have problems with those filmmakers. There's so much of this sort of pompous ego and, look, I'm being crass and, vulgar, and it's for some quote-unquote point. And Bakshi, I think, would like to imagine himself as part of that group in some ways. And I just find it insufferable, because 9 times out of 10, they aren't really communicating, I think, what they believe they are. Or they're not necessarily as thought-provoking as they believe themselves to be. And certainly, and I know that will probably get me in deep trouble with a lot of von Trier's fans.
Well, I mean, as I've said before, like, I reserve most of my anger for movies, not about objectively bad ones, as much as mediocre films that think they're smart. And I think one of the easiest ways to inflate your own sense of what your film is by deliberately courting controversy. Because, I mean, Like, growing up in the 90s, I mean, you and I, like, probably can remember, like, when Amaser came out and, like, it was supposed to be banned in Canada, and then everybody, like, gave an impassioned defense being like, no, this film is controversial because it's artistic and challenging. You know, there's that tendency to be like, well, I mean, Midnight Cowboy is a good example. Rated X and won Best Picture. And the idea that if you're making art, it needs to be difficult. But there's a fine line between that and, like, the guy who just walks up to you on a bus and punches you in the face, and then you're like, why did you do that? He said, because it's so unexpected. I'm transgressive. Give me a Caesar Award.
Yeah, and that's just it. Like, I just do not have the patience or time for most of that stuff. I mean, your film has to be exceptionally good. And I think, again, with Von Trier, it's certainly somebody who, again, when he gets out of his own way, you know, you end up with Dancer in the Dark, one of the greatest movies I've ever seen, but I have zero interest in ever watching again because of how utterly devastating it is.
Yeah, sad musicals.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, most of the time we end up with Dogville, and, you know,
I'm actually looking at my copy of Dogville on the shelf right now, thank you very much. I also have a copy of Manderley.
There we go. We'll get there one day, folks, I'm sure.
Now, just because I have them doesn't mean that they're good. But, you know, it's, I don't know. I think if one thing has become clear over 41 episodes, there's no set model for what a good or enjoyable or interesting film is. And, I mean, no. I think on the outset from this, like, I remember, you know, wringing my hands a lot over, like, oh, well, we have to pick the right starting point, because if we don't, we're going to buttonhole ourselves from the very start as something that we don't want to be. And it turns out, whether you look at The Last Unicorn, White Dog, Eating Raoul, Father Goose even, you know, Bigger Than Life, like, I never thought that I'd be watching these films in the course of a podcast, let alone a podcast that is able to draw connections between these films. But, you know, they're all very fascinating films for very different reasons. And, I mean, if nothing else, I'm further lionized to spend at least another 52 weeks seeing all the different ways we can surprise ourselves some more.
No, absolutely. Which is sort of a good way, I guess, to sort of start wrapping this bonus special up here. With some maybe, let's just say, Andrew, what would we probably say are maybe some goals for 2019 that we have for ourselves here?
Goals, you know, for generally 2019, speaking. Personally, buy a microphone, because
that's a possibility.
Especially, yeah, listening on headphones, I'm like, wow, no wonder David sounds so much more articulate. He doesn't have amplifier buzz and all that crap going on in the background. You at least, you sound the part of a pro. So I like to think that all of our show's failures are them listening to my audio.
You'd be wrong, but...
I also want to do fewer episodes where I'm doing my note prep right until the moment we record, because listening, I mean, when we listen back to our episodes, I mean, there are certain episodes where I will definitely listen to again because I love the conversation we have at the time. And, you know, it's fun to relive and remember all the ways that you crack me up without trying. I definitely, yeah, I want to put a little more preparation in, simply because I spend much less time in every episode going, yeah, so I guess it's kind of like that part in other film when other actor does something. I mean, after a point, it feels like film criticism by way of Family Guy. And I want to avoid having anything to do with Family Guy as long as I live.
I sympathize with you there. Certainly, as I've already stated, I'm making it my goal to eliminate at least one, if not two, words out of my vocabulary as much as possible next year. Putting that aside, the goal is also to stutter less on this show. People, seriously, I'm endlessly fascinated, Andrew, every time we record these things, and then I go back to edit it, because I'm looking at your waveforms as I'm editing versus mine, And it's very clear how we have very distinct talking styles there, because there are usually I can edit yours with, you know, no trouble, because there's nice, crisp little, you know, pauses in between words and fairly easy to find points to snip around.
And that's entirely by accident.
Yeah. Well, when you look at mine, it's just like a big blob of text as I am rushing through everything I am saying, and it all flows into the word after it, and there's never a natural pause point, it feels.
But you know why that is, David? It's because, as I've said before, you have forgotten far more about cinema than most people are ever going to learn. You are a font of knowledge, and I know for a fact that I would not have been able to make this podcast without you.
Thank you very much. I would still say I'm not that much of a font of knowledge. I just read a hell of a lot.
Yeah, and that's more than most people do. That's more than I have time to do these days. So I don't have to do my show notes because I hang out with you.
But there we go.
That being said, Dave, maybe this, maybe for the year to come, we can solve it all by just reminding ourselves at the beginning of every episode, hey, let's not worry. No one's listening anyway. I feel like, yeah, I mean, also, it's an audio medium. I think we're just laser focused on things. I feel like I stutter a lot more when I'm recording. So, you know, give yourself a break, Dave. You're so kind to everyone. Turn some of that kindness on yourself.
Yeah, but that's only because I'm repressing so much rage.
Well, you know what's a great cure-all for repressed rage?
Tiger milk.
A tall, cool glass of lukewarm tiger milk.
Okay, I guess we have sort of reached this point in the show here, folks. Before we indulge in everything that's wrong with the world, Andrew, would you like to remind our listeners what the first episode of 2019 is going to be?
Yes, we thank you for making it this far. We are going to be looking at Don Siegel's The Beguiled, starring Clint Eastwood and a whole lot of ladies. So if we survive the sip that's coming in the next few seconds, you can meet up with us first week of the new year. We'll be back with a brand new run, continuing the same old Shane, and hopefully a little older and a little wiser, and well, me a little more prepared and you a little less precise.
Fair enough. All right then, so I guess we do it now. So, on the count of three.
Okay.
All right. One. Two.
Do it for James Mason.
Three. Oh, God!
You should not have to drink something that thick, that's warm.
Oh.
Using strawberry was a bad idea.
What was wrong with you, 1950s? Just, oh!
Well, is it any wonder that James Mason then tried to murder his family?
No! No! Why did they make it about a cortisone? This alone should have, ah!
Though, to be fair, he never actually drinks the tiger milk.
It's true, he does it. We're just missing the scene where Gene Simmons does right after Walter Matthau gives it to her, and then flies into a rage, destroying everything in her life. Oh, God.
Wait. But we figured it out, because now that we've drank the tiger milk, we're now immune to cortisone addiction.
I still have a bit more in this cup. I mean,
that's okay. I still have a bit more cortisone.
Yeah, that's true. All right, let's go for sip two and see how this goes. Oh, no, that's still awful.
Yeah,
that's...
Nutritional yeast has a very cheesy flavor to it, so, oh, God. I feel like... this feels like if a xenomorph could spit in your mouth. I think it's resembling that, with a hint of strawberry.
I'm never getting the phlegm out. It's done. It's... Wow.
Well, you know what, David? I think we've proven at least one thing. We are dedicated to one another, and we are dedicated to this show. And provided that we don't suddenly contract some weird tropical illness from this, we are also going to be just as dedicated in our next year of episodes as we were in the last.
Absolutely.
It is
so
hard to wind this up on a positive note, because I do think I'm going to throw up.
Well, before we accomplish that, Andrew, do you have any parting words for the listeners of 2018 before we go?
You bet.
Oh, man.
Remember, everybody, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Unless the tiger milk does it first.
Happy New Year, everybody.